Hi, I'm Maggie McGrath, editor of Forbes Women, and today I'm speaking to Natalie Birnbaum. She's the founder of Repro Solutions and a healthcare innovation attorney at Nelson Hardiman, and she's here to break down a recent Supreme Court case. Natalie, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, sure is. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
So just to summarize, this is a drug that had been approved 20 plus years ago. There had been some modifications and changes to the accessibility in more recent years, and especially during the pandemic. And it is into that environment that this case comes. And I was actually going to ask you, in 2020, medication abortions accounted for 53% of all abortions in the U.S. New data from the Guttmacher Institute just this month found that that number has increased, or proportion has increased to 63% of all abortions in America are medication abortions. How does that increase? How does that statistic affect this case and how it is received?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that, you know, again, the goal of these far-right conservative groups is to prevent any abortions from happening in this country. So I think that the increase indicates two things. One, that people are still going to get abortion care. Like, it's a tale as old as time. Like, if you look back to the 1800s, if you look back to the 1950s and the Janes, like, people will find their ways to get abortions. And without access in certain state person care, because the provision is banned in those states, people are finding other ways to get pills. And sometimes that is driving across state lines and mail ordering a pill. Sometimes that is getting a pill sent into your state. There are protections in at least six states in this country for healthcare providers. They're sometimes called shield laws. And those laws basically protect the providers in those states, so such as New York, California, and four other states, including Colorado, where if you're a provider and you mail pills into Texas, you know, while you can't control what Texas is going to do, New York will say, okay, well, we're not going to comply with out-of-state law. So those laws have also led to an increase in the numbers of recipients of pills. But overall, I think those numbers indicate that users and patients have a good experience when they use the pill, that it's safe, it is convenient, it is more private, and it's, again, 97% safe and effective. That's more safe and effective than a Tylenol or a Viagra. So I think that's why we can reasonably see that increase.
So to get to the Supreme Court arguments this week, let's walk through what we heard from the justices. I feel like there are kind of two big questions that we went into Tuesday asking, one of which it was, is there even standing to bring this case to the Supreme Court? And then the secondary question is, I guess, if yes, then did the FDA do something wrong in approving this drug? Let's start with the first question. Is there standing for this case? And from what we heard from the justices this week, do you think the Supreme Court justices think this case has standing?
Yeah, great question. I mean, in my opinion, absolutely not. And like, you know, amongst the legal community, it's absurd to think that there is standing. And I think we heard this echoed from the justices yesterday. Even like Amy Coney Barrett and like other judges that are potentially more conservative leaning seemed to indicate that, you know, they had a really hard time trying to get to how there is standing. And it just is so attenuated, right? So the argument here is that there is standing amongst this group of doctors, emergency room doctors, one of whom is actually a dentist, and these medical associations. These doctors are not prescribing mifepristone. They are not seeing patients outright who have taken mifepristone. And like, how do we get from the FDA's approval process and the FDA protocol to the injury incurred by these doctors? And, you know, I think I read something that summed it up really nicely. And it was like, The stance is that if mifepristone remains on the market and can be prescribed under the FDA's current protocol, then some percentage of people will experience complications. And it is such a small percentage of people that experience complications from mifepristone. But let's just say there are those people, right? Then they end up in the emergency room. And then if they seek care from those emergency room, then one of those doctors may have to be in a situation where they treat those patients. And then those doctors would be in a situation where they would have to weigh saving the life and providing care within the medical standard of care for this woman versus their conscience. And this is what they're claiming they have standing on. But, you know, plaintiffs were not able to point to one, not even one, example where these, where the doctor's conscience were called into question. And furthermore, as Amy Coney Barrett pointed out, the plaintiffs in the case are living in states with abortion bans. So how likely is this even of happening, right? Like, where's the standing there? Where is the injury? And again, it just seemed very clear from the perspective of the justices that they could not find the standing either.
So you mentioned Amy Coney Barrett. Did it seem like the conservative justices are aligning with the more liberal justices here, and we have a more cohesive view of this case across ideological lines?
Listen, I think that the Supreme Court needs to keep its sense of legitimacy in the eyes of the public. Somebody I was listening to yesterday, you know, said the Supreme Court and the laws are kind of like Tinkerbell. If you don't believe in it, it's not real. And the Supreme Court has lost so much legitimacy in the last few years that, you know, when there's a case where there is really just absolutely no good reason to hear because there is no injury by the plaintiffs who are bringing the case, it would really discredit the court to hear this case on the merits. Do I think that the more conservative justices are falling into line on that? I mean, you have Alito and you have Clarence Thomas, who definitely want to do whatever they can to make sure mifepristone isn't on the market and prevent abortion care. So do I think they're falling into line? No. What they were doing yesterday was something else. They were bringing in Comstock, which is a law from the 1800s. And we can talk about that if you're interested.
I was going to ask you how a law from the 19th century played into this. But just to kind of drill down into the standing case, my understanding is that the broader pharmaceutical industry is concerned about this because, let's take it out of the reproductive healthcare space and just talk about, I have seasonal allergies, I have Claritin, and God forbid I take Claritin and I have a negative effect on me, on my health, because I took this allergy medicine. If this case has standing, is there a future in which someone could argue that Claritin should have its FDA approval revoked because I had a negative effect? Like, what are the broader implications on the drug industry if this case were to move forward?
Yeah, absolutely. You hit it on the head. The issue here, like, is way more broad than just abortion or mifepristone. This case has the opportunity to impact healthcare innovation in this country and in the world, because, you know, we are a leader in this country in healthcare innovation. So much more broadly, there are millions and billions of dollars that go into R&D for pharmaceutical companies to adhere to the FDA's rigorous approval process. And if all of a sudden we are living in a world where anyone who is claiming an injury can bring a case to overturn the FDA's decision when they are the agency entrusted with our healthcare regulatory decisions, well then why would drug companies invest this money in this country to do those things, right? Like, we need to have some sort of structure and respect for that structure and stability in order to function. And if we find standing for these plaintiffs, if the justices find standing for these plaintiffs, it's really setting up a future where anything goes, and anyone can bring these cases, which will not only disrupt the healthcare industry, but will totally clog up our judicial system.
So if there is no standing found, what happens? And when do we find that out? What are the next steps in that case?
So we'll probably find out in June. So it'll take a bit of time. If there's no standing in this case, what will happen is it will be dropped from the Supreme Court and it'll probably go back to the Fifth Circuit. It will go back to Judge Kaczmarek because there were two parties that sought to intervene in the case, and they may be under Judge Kaczmarek's court, they may be allowed to intervene, and then the case will come out again and maybe they'll find a more creative argument. But I think that it's important to remember the larger context that we're in right now politically. You know, we're approaching a summer before an election. And we also know that abortion is a winning issue for the Democratic Party. It's also a unifying issue in what seems to be a deeply divided time. So whatever happens is going to be very strategic in order to ensure, if you're talking about the anti-abortion extremist side of things, in order to temper, let's say, the Democratic Party's and people in this country, people who value abortion, people who value bodily autonomy and healthcare, their willingness to go to the poll and be a single voter, single issue voter on abortion care.
So that's, I asked about if there's no standing found. If the court does find that this case has standing, do they then move on to the next question, which was, should Mifepristone have FDA regulation or approval? Sorry, let me re-ask that. If the Supreme Court finds that the plaintiffs did have standing, do have standing, then what? Then we're looking for a decision on the FDA's approval of Mifepristone?
Yeah, so we wouldn't be, so the questions presented are whether or not, the second question presented besides the standing issue is whether or not we should roll back Mifepristone to the 2016 risk evaluation and mitigation strategies, the REMS requirements. There are 7 drugs on the market now with REMS requirements. It is very, very rare, and they're typically reserved for drugs that have a high chance of addictiveness, which obviously mifepristone isn't a drug that one becomes addicted to. So what would happen is this drug would not be taken off the market entirely, most likely. However, we go back to 2016, and in the 2016 REMS, there is a 3 in-person visitation requirement, and that would essentially prevent telehealth for medication abortion from happening. And that would be hugely, hugely disrupted, especially from an equity perspective, where medication abortion through telehealth is able to reach rural populations, it is able to reach populations in abortion care deserts, maternal health care deserts, which there are only increasing numbers of in this country. And it would really just be a devastating impact to not only, you know, abortion seekers, but the healthcare industry generally. You know, since the pandemic, telehealth has really boomed. And at a state level and at a federal level, we are seeing increasing permissions for telehealth use. And to take that away for mifepristone, when once again, it is 97% safe and effective, it should be over the counter in the first place based on those safety and efficacy ratings, right? Like, to take that away is going to have a huge detrimental impact all over the country, even in states where they're blue states, like New York. I'm sitting in Brooklyn right now. I will be impacted. Everybody in this state will be impacted. And I think it's a really, really important point to get across, because so often people in coastal cities, people in blue states, aren't tuned into these conversations because these issues don't impact us in the same way because our states protect us. But this is federal. Everyone mm-hmm. will be impacted.
We also saw this month the introduction of over-the-counter birth control in certain states, including New York. Is there a world or scenario in which this mifepristone case then dampens the ability to get over-the-counter birth control?
That's a great question. Well, I think let's go back to the conversation we started to have on Comstock, because that's where this becomes relevant. So just to turn back the hands of time for a moment, the Comstock Act, as you said, is a 19th century law that is an anti-vice law. And actually, I think the language is, it bans lewd, lascivious, and obscene information from going through the mail. I mean, like lascivious, I'm sure that half of the judges here don't even know what that word means. But so what we're talking about here is a ban on mailing abortifacients, again, a word that feels so arcane, and all you know, vice. So that also includes contraception, right? Like sorry, contraceptives. And if, you know, Thomas and Alito have their way and Comstock is back on the table, then yeah, there's a chance where contraceptives are no longer able to be sent in the mail. And I want to be clear that even if Comstock isn't, you know, given the thumbs up in this case, if it's dropped on standing, it is a dormant federal law that hasn't been enforced in over 100 years, but it is still on the books. So really what's needed is a repeal of Comstock. And it like felt absurd to even repeal this law because it's irrelevant and has been irrelevant. It hasn't been enforced in 100 years. But now it's a main talking point of the like extreme right and the conservative movement to say, hey, if we get back in power, we are going to enforce Comstock. So we are really hopeful, and Representative Cori Bush is actually the first elected official as of yesterday to demand that we repeal Comstock. Because again, if Trump is elected in office, we can live in a world, regardless of this case, where the mailing of contraception is now prohibited. And also, it's not just the mailing to patients, it's going in the mail in general. So I'm talking about like from pharmaceutical companies and distributors sending it in the mail to doctors, to hospitals, like no mailing at all. It's really absurd.
I feel like there's probably a tangent where Viagra could fall under threat in that world. But I think more broadly, what I'm hearing from you is that more readers and viewers should probably read up on Comstock and have an understanding of that going into this election cycle.
Yeah, I wish that wasn't the case, because again, it just feels so absurd. But yeah, I mean, I would really encourage viewers to activate around, you know, asking their representatives to make sure that Comstock is repealed, and also just really understanding that even if you are in a blue state, like I'm sure many of your viewers are, this will impact us. And like our vote really, really matters, because whatever happens, even if this is dropped on standing, there's a bigger strategy at play here. And make no mistake that goal is to end abortion access in this country. And like maybe this is gonna, they're gonna take the L, but it's not over. And it really matters where our vote goes, because again, Comstock is still technically a law.
You started this conversation talking about the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine and how that was formed in August 2022. This case could end up being a loss for them, but you seem to think that they might keep going. Do we know who is funding them? Who are the players behind this organization, and what else should we be watching for from them?
Yeah, so there is a larger national movement, and if you just look at what has been happening at the states, both before Dobbs, after Dobbs, there is a concerted effort to use language like fetal personhood and to create a power structure and a dynamic when the life of an embryo has more value than the life of a woman. And there is a goal here to get rid of abortion access throughout the country, and to also get rid of contraceptive access. And, you know, this isn't a secret. There's something called like the 2025 plan. You can just Google it. It's very obvious. It's out there. The information is all out there. And like, we want to live in a country where we have equitable, safe access to healthcare as women, and where our lives are valued. You know, the argument in this case that the doctors were making were, you know, they don't want to be put in a circumstance where they have to choose between their conscious value and saving a woman's life. Now, to me, I'm like, if you're an emergency room doctor and your immediate instinct isn't to save the life of the woman, regardless of your feelings about a certain type of healthcare, I mean, that to me is the inherent problem. We should be valuing the life of the living and the life of women. And until we are doing that and centering patient care, women's care, and the care of children, especially, you know, centering equity and patients who don't have access to healthcare, Medicaid patients, rural patients, low-income patients, Black and Brown and minority communities, our maternal mortality rates in this country are the highest in the developed world and 3.5 times higher for Black women. And the rates of maternal mortality are significantly higher in states with abortion bans. OBGYN units are closing all over the country. Doctors are choosing not to go into OBGYN care because of bans. So these are the issues we really want to think about. And if we, you know, to your question, to your point of like, who's behind this? I mean, far right nationalist, Christian extremist groups. And they're a minority of the population. The majority of this country believes in the right to get abortion. But this small vocal minority has taken power through gerrymandering, through voter suppression, through all of these different ways. And now this is the country that we live in. And we have to do everything we can in order to ensure that our votes are getting out there, our voices are getting out there, and we're protecting not just access to abortion care, but to democracy.
Well, Natalie, that was a comprehensive overview of what we've seen out of the Supreme Court this week. Thank you so much for answering our questions and sitting down with us. I'm sure we will be talking again soon.
Thank you so much for your time. It was great to talk with you.